So the title, Illiberal Justice, Free Speech, The Death of Adulthood, Maybe. The maybe, at least originally, was meant to suggest, okay, maybe things aren't quite as bad as the title portends. But then I thought about it, maybe, perhaps, the maybe should refer to, I should have chosen a different title altogether. But we'll try to make sense of it as we go along here. I was looking, you've had me out here many times now for a number of years, I appreciate that. I was looking over a number of the talks that I've given, and a handful, I'm happy to say, I actually knew what I was talking about. The few that I didn't, look, somebody had to be here, right? Anyway, so might as well have been me. I think I know a little bit about what I'm talking about today, but it's also an exploration, because I'm very much in the middle of something that's quite difficult and quite challenging, especially at the university. So it's on higher education. It's on whether free speech in higher education. Some of the ideological battles we're fighting. The illiberal suggests a kind of rigidity and orthodoxy, a narrative that can't be challenged. Something that doesn't allow for complexity, for nuance, that becomes a party line of one kind or another, and if you dissent from it in any way, there is no possibility of recovering from that career-wise, reputationally, credibility, et cetera, et cetera. And there are a lot of reasons why that's probably come up, especially at universities right now. Illiberal justice means there's an application of this rigid orthodoxy or this particular narrative to cases that would otherwise demand, again, some nuanced due process, the possibility of thinking through them according to fairer norms than what oftentimes is happening at universities at the moment. So I want to explore that. I want to explore a little bit the chilling effect that some of these new orthodoxies are having on free speech and the ways in which the professoriate are both censoring and self-censoring in terms of what's allowed, and then the consequences of that in terms of what the purpose of higher education is and what that's gonna mean for society at large. The death of adulthood gets into some of the things that you've probably heard and or talked about here and other places. And that is, if you're growing up not having your particular views challenged in any particular way, your values challenged in any sort of a robust way, if you're in lockstep, if there's a kind of groupthink, if there isn't room for other perspectives, what's called viewpoint diversity, it's difficult to get past some of your own attachments in ways that help you understand, see, appreciate, empathize with the fact that there might be other people on the planet. Right? If adulthood means anything, it probably means, I'm not a Freudian, but I sometimes tell my clients, well, I'm not a Freudian either. There are some things about Freud that might have been right. One of them was probably the reality principle, and at some point, to be an adult means you're no longer consider yourself the absolute center of the universe. And so that's one part of something that oftentimes should, in my mind, happen at a university. So I'm going to refer, again, I've used him in the past here. He's a relatively influential thinker, not only in my life, but in the lives of really a whole conversation about moral psychology and what's happening at the universities and society at large. That's, again, Jonathan Haidt, the moral psychologist who wrote The Righteous Mind, and most recently, The Coddling of the American Mind, in which he says, there are a lot of bad ideas being expressed in a lot of unfortunate ways in universities, and we're raising a generation of kids who are not terribly resilient, or not only not resilient. He goes on to say, resiliency is one thing. You know, something's resilient, you can hit it, doesn't break, it's resilient. He said, it's worse than that, actually. It's they're fragile. And what we want are anti-fragile graduates. We want anti-fragile people. We want folks who, when you hit them, they break, but they grow back stronger. It's like, all right, you're right. Maybe I was wrong about that. Wow, you really deeply offended me, but somehow I'll come back from that. I'll come back to that with a better way to articulate what I believe, stronger emotionally. And you grow up, right? And you grow up with a sense of what it means to appreciate complexity, ambiguity, nuance, et cetera, et cetera. And in the ways in which this particular orthodoxy that I'm going to describe tends to protect students from a lot of challenges these days, there's a great cost to them, to us, and to the future. So he's calling for something like a schism. He said, we're at a point in higher education where we really need, not unlike the early church or perhaps the Jungian, Freudian split, you know, choose your particular moment from history, we need a schism. We need to come down on one side or the other. He said, either the university can come down on the side of social justice, we're a social justice institution, we're for change, we're going to make a better society, this is how we're going to do it, no holds barred, unapologetic, or we are, and this would be the older version, we're on the side of truth, wherever truth lands us, even if it doesn't fit any particular given social justice narrative at the time. Now, that's a scary thing for people who like to think that they're on both sides, right? Say, well, wait a minute, can't you do both? Isn't that a false dichotomy? He's saying, and he's not alone in this, he's got a lot of company, at the moment, it's very difficult to come down on the side of both because there are a number of what he, as a social scientist, considers to be truths that nonetheless cannot be expressed. And I'll give you one example right off the top of my head, and I gotta tell you, I'm even a little nervous doing it here. You're a friendly, sane audience, but, mostly. But this is being recorded, right? And these days, if you are a professor, you are, for reasons good and not so good, challenged to think pretty carefully about what you say out loud and the way even one person might interpret it, take it, run with it, challenge it, and you know, all of a sudden you find yourself for weeks on end defending your life, your thoughts, your very existence to the higher-ups who may or may not be sympathetic because they may or may not be adults themselves, which is a whole other issue. We'll get to later on. Fortunately, I have a dean who's very much an adult and has, on a couple of occasions already, supported me. But I'll give you an example to see if we can ground this a little bit. So, in all of the upheaval of last summer, Black Lives Matter coming to the fore yet again, shooting of young black men, the defund the police movement, et cetera, scholars do what they're supposed to do. They take a step back, take a more dispassionate view of things, interview folks, do qualitative, quantitative studies. What's really at issue here, you know? And according to those who are willing to actually express this out loud, the truth on the ground is that the defund the police movement in Minneapolis was stopped by the black community, not by white allies who, you know, joined them to virtue signal. And it was stopped because they don't want less policing, they want better policing, right? And here's where the narrative gets funky. If you say that out loud as a social scientist, as a professor of management, like I just did, right, that all by itself can leave you in a fairly fraught and perilous position these days. Truth, defund the police is not exactly what we think. There are black communities, the greatest threat to young black men is actually other young black men, not the police, even though the police are a problem. Nobody's on the side is wants to make the dichotomy, right? This is where the adulthood piece comes in, where the nuance comes in. We're not saying both aren't bad. Both are a problem. Both require investigation. Both require inquiry. You know, we want to address all of it and come to the best solutions we can. But when you take certain conversations or the ability to say certain things absolutely off the table, you know, well, you must be on the side of defund the police, otherwise you're clearly a white supremacist and a racist, et cetera, right? You immediately curtail what the university is at least traditionally supposed to be doing, which is arguing for this kind of free, unfettered inquiry. Haidt goes on to say this is only 40 pages, so do you have other things to do today? Or, are you okay? You good? Okay. All right, well, this is important, okay? So you're gonna, no. He goes on to point out a couple of other things, and this is, I think, well corroborated. And that is that just in the last 15 to 20 years, the professoriate has changed pretty dramatically in terms of, especially in the humanities and social sciences, how it lines up politically. And so you might have found in just a random sample of universities and colleges across the country 20, 25, 30 years ago, a kind of what he suggests is a 4-to-1 ratio of people who are center-left to left to conservative right. And that's fine. As long as you've got that one conservative voice in there, kind of disconfirmation voice, where you've got to check yourself, you've got to prove yourself, you've got to give good reasons and evidence for why you believe the way you do, that's good. And the 4-to-1 ratio is workable. You can do that. But in certain places around the country now, a growing number of faculty, it's 20-to-1, it's 40-to-1. In his own psychology department at NYU, it's closer to 41. He's kind of funny. He says, I know the one conservative guy. He probably won't be with us much longer. What happens if you get a 20, 40, 60? At Brown, it's a 60-to-1, self-reporting, right? 60-to-1 in the humanities. People identify as left, progressive, liberal, radical, as opposed to the one conservative voice. Well, in faculty, you get a kind of groupthink, right, obviously. And you get also less disconfirmation. And you get a kind of, even if you're within the left, you're different flavors of left, right? And he says, you know, you always know which side is wrong. It's the side that shoots its own dissidents. And even some like me, he's like, on most things, I'm sort of back and forth, but most things probably skew a little bit left. But if I say something that doesn't, again, fit the narrative, if I publish on it, if it's out there, no matter how well-reasoned or how much evidence there is behind it, it becomes more difficult for me to gain credibility standing if everybody else is lockstep farther to the left than I am. So it's bad for faculty discussion, it's bad for disconfirmation, it's bad for the future of research, it's bad for discovering what might be true in lots of cases. And this is more the humanities and social sciences than the hard sciences. He said, but it's even worse for students, because, and we were talking about this a little bit in the pre-talk, you come in with a set of values, a worldview, it's usually not as well articulated, as well reasoned as somebody who's older. That's the whole point, or one of the points of going to college, right? Not to make you an accountant, but to help make you a citizen, right? How do you do that? You get exposed to lots of different points of view. But that, again, viewpoint diversity now is much, much less in evidence than it used to be. And so you get students more and more, the argument goes, who come into college and leave college not knowing what they don't know, because they're less and less exposed to a number of viewpoints that would have challenged those in the first place. And then you get the students who are center, right of center, who feel like they're walking on eggshells because anything they say doesn't fit a particular left orthodoxy. And the students who on the left, who nonetheless don't necessarily agree with some of the other more excessive or intense or extreme viewpoints of the left themselves being shot. And so while I have been teaching mostly in graduate programs, there the conversation is pretty free-flowing still. Once people are out in the corporate world, they come back, they want the bang for their buck. They're less intimidated by these kinds of conversations. But oh my goodness, trying to have a conversation with a group of 20-year-olds right now who are aware that, you know, anybody can misinterpret anything in any number of ways, and then either haul you or you as the student and call you out in ways that are not just, they're not a challenge. What they are punitive, right? They want you to be punished. As one student said the other day, he said, the relationship between woke culture and cancel culture is that if I'm not woke, I'm canceled, right? One follows from the other. I don't want to be canceled, and so on that side. So I'll give you one other, one thing to say that, about this. I'll give you one other example, talk brief definition of woke, but then argue out of both sides of my mouth here, because I was caught up short by something that the real nuance here, the complication is, you've got a lot of different scholars right now, commentators who are, you know, I suppose being brave in challenging this kind of higher education leftist orthodoxy, especially around being woke, being excessively aware of racist and sexist histories, and then, you know, not allowing any other narrative to permeate that particular view of things. And they're trying to straddle this fine line between, well, of course there's a real problem. Of course there's real sexism and racism. Of course there's a history of systemic problems, structural problems. We know all of that. Said, the problem is we've gone so far to this notion of claiming everybody on that side of the scale is a victim, that we've gone from a dignity culture in which sticks and stones may break my bones, you know, but you gotta get tough, you gotta, you know, get in there and mix it up, to protecting everybody from everybody else and saying you can't say anything that anybody else might find offensive in any way, shape, or form. And if he goes as far as to say that we're in this victimhood culture in higher education. I have a friend, former student, who's a constitutional law scholar, who's watching all this stuff play out at law schools, who said, this is a new McCarthyism. I mean, he's not afraid to say, because people like me are self-censoring to such a strong degree these days to try to avoid any problem, even if you're tenured, right? Even if you can see retirement from where you're standing. I said that the other day, we were in a conversation with some undergraduate seniors, and I said, look, you know, there are some ways in which I probably don't share as much provocative material as I used to in the past. Maybe I don't go as far. Maybe I don't make a couple of the jokes that I used to make that used to get, you know, rousing laughter and now get quizzical and somewhat, you know, doubting looks. I said, I don't do that. And they kind of sat there for a second, and then young woman in front, who's very good in class, piped up and said, well, that makes me angry. I said, well, can you say more? I said, no, I'm too angry. No, she said, she said, look, yeah. I said, so what you're telling me is that not only you, but probably, and nationwide, the percentage is about 30-40%, said, you guys are holding back. You're not engaging us as much as you said maybe you're a prior generation of students because you're a little afraid of this minority, but very, very vocal minority that could make life very difficult for you and others. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, why? That's cowardly. I said, yeah. I said, what's your point? So I'm trying to do it less. And I think Grand Valley is a good place to do it because by dint of being a little more conservative than some other places and very practically minded students in lots of ways, you can go meta. You can say, look, this is what I'm doing. But for example, I used to go into classes really up until just a couple of years ago and say, it's an ethics class, right? I mean, it's all hot button issues. Say, all right, look, you're probably going to get offended at some point in this class. And if being offended is the worst thing that ever happens to you, what a charmed life. Good for you, being offended. Make you tougher, more resilient, anti-fragile. You'll have to come up with better arguments. You're going to be a better person. You should thank me. You're not paying nearly enough for this class. You know, on and on. I don't say that anymore. Now what I say is, if you find material in the class offensive, you might, some of it, please raise that as an issue. I'm aware that some of these things are quite delicate and quite difficult, and let me know, and let's talk about those particular issues. I'm not particularly proud of that, right? And it's not just me. I've talked to folks in the philosophy department from whence I come and other departments who have said much the same thing to me. It's like, we feel like the core of the teaching is still there. We still feel like, you know, we have integrity in terms of the pedagogy, but we're more careful around the edges than we ever used to be before. Height and those who agree with him, who are a growing number at this point, said, that's really, really unfortunate. You're perpetuating this notion of what it means to be a victim. And you're saying to the white students in class, you know, if you want to signal your own status, become an ally of these folks who are victims. So how do you gain status now? Not by, as John McWhorter would say, working alongside us to work for greater justice, you know, take a political point of view and work towards it in some way, but now by controlling the language. And I think that's partly our fault, too. If you have kids in college or if you can remember back, I think I agree with this. One of the things that I remember about being an undergraduate is my classes, I love my professor, it was a great experience, but one of the things I remember about it is like, welcome 18-year-old to college, here's everything that's wrong with society. We have a long list of complaints. You know, it goes on and on. There's so many things wrong, and you'll be charged to fix them because we couldn't figure it out. So, and there was that sense of, you get a language of complaint coming out of the university, and that substitutes for anything like real political action. We're not good at teaching people how to actually organize to do anything about it, to become citizens in the sense of voting members, active members, engaged members of society. And so I think a lot of these vocal minorities that have taken on this woke nomenclature and are controlling a lot of what's going on right now have come to understand, well, language is the way to control how people will act. Speech and act are not the same thing, but if we can control speech, we can minimize the number of actions we consider to be harmful to others. But I'll give you an example of where it goes. Some of you may have seen it. It's, by the way, before I do that, one of the most prominent black members of the community who's pushing back on this is John McWhorter, who, New York Times columnist. He's a linguist at Columbia, has written a lot on this kind of thing. He resents the whole thing. He says, of course there's been racism, of course there's been systemic. He said, but the last 50, 60 years actually did happen. So the civil rights movement actually happened. He said, and I don't want to be infantilized by a bunch of virtue signaling white people who think that the only thing I'm good for is for them to reach out a hand to. He said, I like to think I've done some things on my own. I said, I like to think that I've, you know, there's some merits here to what I've accomplished. Too much of woke culture from his point of view, even the kind of anti-racism things that he hears, he's not a fan of those, has the net effect of, again, perpetuating this notion of victimhood and infantilization. It's a third wave feminist critique too, right, as I understand it, which is, you know, especially sex positive feminists, as I understand, say, look, you know, I don't need a man like just protecting me 24 hours a day. So that's kind of infantilization. Said, well, I don't want protection, I want equality. I don't want to be infantilized, I want to be respected for what I can and do accomplish on my own. So that's part of this tension back and forth between what's happening. But let me give you the Georgetown case and go through it a little bit, and then one of the rejoinders from a young student in one of my other classes. So the case was this. There were two adjunct professors at Georgetown Law School, top 20 law school in the country, and they were having a conversation that they thought was off the record after class. They had not yet submitted grades. It was just in the middle of the semester. Students had taken a test. So they weren't anywhere close to final grades yet. And the one professor was bemoaning that, gee, he said, you know, even though I've got some black students who do really well, there are too many black students who end up at the bottom of the class. And the other one kind of went, huh, yeah. And she went on a little bit about that, and he really didn't respond in any strong way to what she was saying. But except to say, you know, maybe this is a bias, maybe we need to check ourselves, maybe we need to do something different. You know, it was a very sort of benign conversation in terms of fitting into an age-old faculty conversation about who does well, who doesn't, why, what some of the factors might be. Turned out that was recorded, and then it was released on Twitter. Black student brought it to the dean of the law school. He immediately issued, this is abhorrent, we can't tolerate this, this is racist, this is horrible, 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 and got out to the public. The one adjunct professor was about to resign. He swooped in and fired her. The other one resigned a couple days later after this all blew up, right? And the narrative, again, was you can't even raise the question right now, right? You can't have a casual conversation. What's behind this? I mean, you would think that would be a good thing, right? I'm asking myself, you know? Why do some of my students fare worse than others? Do I have a bias? Do I need to check this? What's going on here? You know, even the mention out loud, even though it wasn't intended for public consumption, that, well, you know, some of the black students are doing end up at the bottom of the class, it's absolutely verboten. and they're gone, they're fired, you know, and I can replicate that. You say, well, is that really just a crazy one-off incident? FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, a group of mostly legal scholars and lawyers, was formed about three years ago, in response to these cases. They get about 150 of these kinds of cases a month right now. This is really widespread. Some of them they litigate, some of them they do some due diligence, it goes away. Some of them don't rise to that. The point is that you've got, across the country, an awful lot of students and professors walking on eggshells. And Haidt saying, all right, time to make fish or cut bait here. Do you want to be a social change institution and just kind of ignore some of these other conversations that free speech, free inquiry, people are adults who can handle complicated, nuanced, difficult conversations, can engage in? Or do you want to be a social justice institution, right? Here's the narrative. White people are bad. White supremacy is a real thing. It's all about systemic racism without any nuance at all, right? Just, even though we might agree with some of those things, any kind of truth, small or large T truth, that disrupts that narrative is just automatically off the table. You can't bring it up. And he cites Brown University, so about 60-1 left to conservative, progressive to conservative ratio. And he said, they've been very clear. Good for them, right? $100 million donor. It's all about diversity and equity and inclusion. Again, prima facie, good things. We'll devote ourselves to that. Brown University, one of the Ivy League schools, is now going to be devoted to social justice. Chicago, University of Chicago, if you know anything about it, an old line, traditional, great books, curriculum. Not surprisingly, they said, we're not going. For us, they released something called the Chicago Statement, set of principles devoted to that old line notion of, look, we are in the business of discovering truth, small t, capital T truth, wherever, however that lies through any means that are credible, said, if you are offended, if you are deeply disturbed, if you are in other ways, unsettled by what we're doing here, perhaps this is not the place for you. Because that's, in the end, that's the only thing we prejudice is truth. Not your feelings, not anything else. Higher education is at that point, right? Well, what difference does it make? And I'll end on this. You've got the concern about infantilization through groupthink, through lack of diversity of viewpoints, about a victim culture in which I will not stand up for myself, but instead run to some authority and say, help, do something about those people, those are the bad people. This kind of Manichaean divide between we're the good people, they're the bad people, we've got to sort out, we'll have to win by any means necessary, et cetera. Compounded by social media. And I know that's the whipping boy for, everything that's wrong right now. Well, things were so much better before social media. Well, they were, first of all. But, but then, second of all, in terms of, this comes from a woman named Susan Greenfield, who's a, she's a some kind of synaptic pharmacologist, neuroscientist at Oxford. I can barely even say her title, but I think I understand more or less what she's up to. Said, look, all this liking, all this sharing, all this sort of, reiteration and confirmation of my groupthink narrative, et cetera, is leading to shorter and shorter attention spans, greater senses of anger, less and less ability to process complex information over time. So it's the infantilization of the adolescent and college age, young adult, She said, by the mid-21st century, she said, if things don't change, she expects your average college graduate to be reasoning about the level of a sixth or seventh grader and to be more swept up by emotions than by reason or evidence or logic. The terrible, terrible, tragic irony of that, and why it's so necessary for people like me, I think, and to join Haidt and push back against a lot of what's happening, is that think about the problems that particular generation is facing. Right. Have there ever been any greater number of existential threats to humanity? Well, you could say, well, yeah, we grew up with a bomb. Well, okay, there was that. But in terms of climate change, the continued threat of nuclear annihilation, inequality, growing numbers of authoritarian regimes again, I mean, just think about all of them. What do they all require? They all require people to be able to think well, deeply, pay attention to and attend to various kinds of information, disparate information over time, put that together and come together to act in concert, right? What's being lost in both the sort of the dominance of this kind of woke culture that I'm talking about and through social media, the ability to do that. And on this final note, however, right, just so we don't think it's all necessarily bad, I was sobered by this, and it's why I said this is an exploration for me as well as something I need to act on. Young woman of color in class last semester, we were all kind of dancing around this and saying, yeah, this is too bad, we can't really talk about anything anymore, blah, blah, blah. And she very matter-of-factly, and I think astutely, said, well, wait a minute. She said, you know, I understand there's a caricature of woke, there's a caricature of this narrative. She said, but put yourself in my position for just a second. She said, look, I'm a young woman of color, ancestors going generations back. She said, okay, two white, relatively privileged law school professors lose their position because they said some insensitive and maybe even misinterpreted things about black students. He said, 200, 300, 400, 500 otherwise well-situated white people, you know, may come under some duress because the pendulum has swung a little bit too far. She said, the pendulum needs to swing that far. Think about how easy it was to dismiss generation after generation people who look like me, people who came from my background, women of color, men of color. Think about everything that's happened to us. Said, if this just, the pendulum goes a little too far right now, you know, to help pull it towards the center eventually, where that kind of equality you all say you want actually becomes a real thing. Said, I'm willing to sacrifice those handful of folks, given everything that we've sacrificed to get to where we are. And we all kind of shut up for a moment and said, well, okay, that's worth thinking about. Anyway, the point is, as you hear these conversations about what appeared to be absurd cases coming out of universities, where things have gone way too far, on one hand, maybe they have. On the other hand, for some people, the people who have been most affected by it, perhaps they see it a little differently. A place like this is about moral imagination, right? We always talk about that. I know that I'm not as good at it as I could be, so we do want that viewpoint diversity. When it comes up, when it disrupts our own narrative, whatever side of the spectrum we're on, again, the plea is, listen, you know, there might be something to wake up to after all.